Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 27th of August. From 1976 to 1990, Nikki Sunt worked for the U.S. Forest Service as a firefighter, including six seasons as a smoke jumper. By 1988, he was making the connection between wildfires and climate change. He now works for the World Wildlife Fund, and he says that he has seen dramatic changes in the frequency of forest fires in the U.S. In the 70s and the 80s, the fires weren't as big or as intense. They are much hotter now, he says, more extreme and erratic. And the amount of money used to control fires last year, the government spent $1.5 billion to fight more than 63,000 wildfires across the country. Nearly 5 million acres in Alaska have burned this year. Wildfires are on pace to become the largest ever in Alaska's history. So we'll make the connection between these fires and climate change this hour of our program and ask, what do we do about this? It's only getting worse, and there is a huge human cost to this and a financial cost as well. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Nikki is 1-800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Nikki, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thank you so much. These fires are just, they're dominating the news. There are so many of them. It's interesting that you were starting to make a connection between fires and climate change some years ago. Why?
Well, in 1987, I was on some fires in southern Oregon that were started by something like 1,900 lightning strikes. And it was very dry, and the amount of fire that was ignited by those storms just was amazing and really taxed our ability to manage the whole situation. And that following year, I was working for the Office of Technology Assessment here in Washington, D.C. on climate change, and forests were part of that work that I was doing. And that's kind of when I was making the connection. And then in 1988, also, we had this very severe drought, and it was a very hot summer. So it all kind of came together in 1988.
So is the drought one of the primary reasons for all the horrendous fires this year, Nikki?
Well, I think as climate change, as the planet warms up, we're seeing the usual things that in the past always would cause very active fire seasons, like drought, are being aggravated by the higher temperatures associated with climate change. So it's drying things out sooner. The snow is melting sooner in the spring, and so the fires can get going earlier, and the fuels are drying out more extensively. So when you do have a fire, it's going to tend to be larger than it otherwise would be. Then on top of that, you have lightning. And if you get a lot of lightning on top of really dry fuels, then you've got a serious fire situation like we have this year.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about this connection. Two-thirds of the carbon loss in California occurring on the 6% of the state that has been burned by wildfire.
Yeah, so over the last century, we've been suppressing wildfire relatively successfully in the lower 48 states. And as a consequence of that, we have a lot of vegetation and a lot of dead fuel sitting on the floor of our wildlands. So that when we do have a fire, it tends to release a lot more carbon, which is really one of the key components of the trees and of the debris on the forest floor. We're releasing a lot more of that carbon into the atmosphere. So as we get more large fires in these areas with a lot of carbon in them, we're getting very large emissions of carbon.
We're also, I can't remember this happening I remember it happening a little bit last year, but we in Milwaukee area are getting warnings about the quality of the air, and they say it's due to wildfires in Canada, and other states have been getting that from wildfires in Alaska. It's causing air alerts in many parts of the U.S., isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. I mean, you brought up Alaska and Canada. Not to diminish in any way what's happening in the lower 48 right now, of the acreage that's burned in the U.S. so far this year, which is 7.7 million acres, about two-thirds of that was in Alaska. So Alaska's really, most of the acreage that's burned has been in Alaska, and at the same time, Canada has seen almost 15 million acres burned. So there's a lot of acreage that's burning to the north, and in those northern latitudes, particularly in towards the subarctic region and in the Arctic, you've got a lot of carbon in the soil, and so these fires are burning down deep into what used to be frozen. In some cases, it's burning down deep into that and producing a tremendous amount of smoke that drifts in some cases all the way across the Atlantic Ocean into Europe and into even as far as Turkey.
What a huge number, 7.7 million acres in Alaska, 15 million acres in Canada?
Yeah, and what's even more concerning to us is that it isn't just in North America. If you cross over the Pacific Ocean and go to Russia, they've actually seen a burn in Siberia twice, I mean not twice, but more than Alaska and Canada combined.
Mm.
And smoke from those fires has crossed the Pacific Ocean and gone clear across the United States and out the other side into the Atlantic.
Mm. And then you also cite the soot from these fires that's being deposited, Greenland, North Atlantic, falling on ice and snow, and then that absorbs sunlight, which speeds up the melting process.
Yeah, it gets very kind of interesting and complicated, but the smoke, obviously, for people who live in these areas, the first concern is just the health issues, and particularly in areas like Washington and Oregon and Idaho and Montana right now where the fires are really concentrated. And then as the smoke continues to drift around the northern hemisphere, it can be deposited in places like Greenland that are covered with ice. And so you get this soot depositing on ice or snow. It makes it darker, it absorbs more sunlight, and accelerates the melt. And in fact, one of the biggest melt years ever in Greenland was 2012, and research suggests that one of the factors involved with that was soot deposited from wildfires in North America.
Mm. Nikki, you were a firefighter from 76 to 1990. Almost 29,000, I've read, firefighters are battling blazes across the West right now. It's not enough. They're calling on volunteers. The Christian Science Monitor had a piece a couple days ago. They're calling on firefighters from Australia to come in and help fight this. This is, you can't find enough firefighters to contain these fires, and it must be a horribly risky job and dangerous job for those who are fighting these.
Yeah. So what we're seeing, we're pulling in firefighters from Canada, New Zealand, and Australia now. And I think that what happens when you get a huge fire season like this is you start exhausting your resources. And what that means, it means several things. One, it most likely means that some of these fires are going to get bigger than they otherwise would, just because you don't have the resources that you would like to apply to them. But from my personal perspective, having experienced some really severe fire seasons and also having had to deploy my fire shelter at least once, was that you sometimes are the Forest Service and other agencies are put in a position where they're putting firefighters on fires without really being able to back them up. And so you have firefighters that are very tired, that are facing really conditions that are beyond their capacity. And so you're more likely to have incidents where firefighters are forced to deploy their shelters, or in some cases you have injuries or fatalities associated with these fires.
And what are the shelters?
So the shelters are I don't know if many of your listeners are familiar with space blankets. They're these. They're kind of these aluminum, special aluminum. They look like little tiny pup tents, and all firefighters are supposed to carry these with them on fires. And if they are in a situation where they can't get away from a fire, they can't get to a safe area. The last ditch measure is to take this thing out of the container that it's in, shake it out, and get underneath. And there are little handles that you can put your hands and your feet through to hold it down over you. And it basically reflects the heat from the fire for a short period of time. It's not a guarantee. Many times these fatalities, the firefighters are actually in their shelters, but it can keep a firefighter relatively safe from a lower intensity and quick burnover.
Yeah. So where were you when you had to use that?
That was in Idaho, it was when I first started smoke jumping. It was, I think, 1982, and there were lightning storms had come up through Oregon and then out through Idaho and into Montana, and they started hundreds of fires, and a couple of plane loads of jumpers jumped this fire, and we landed in one drainage, one kind of canyon, and then climbed up over the ridge and then fought the fire for about 24 hours.
Mm.
And eventually a thunderstorm came over, started pushing the fire out of our control. We retreated up to the ridge top. Some of us went down to get our gear, and the fire hooked around into the bottom of the canyon that we were in, and we were basically trapped. So we deployed our shelters, and fortunately for us, the wind shifted that night, and we were able to get back up to the ridge very early in the morning before the wind shifted again. And then the wind shifted, the fire came through, and it burned everything that we had left behind.
Oh, my goodness. And in the meantime, you had no idea if you'd get out of there, I'm sure.
No. I kept wondering, where's the cavalry?
Right.
And so when I hear about these other incidents since then, it really, and I think this is really a common feeling among many firefighters, is that It really resonates. I mean, when I hear about these incidents, I want to know everything about it, what happened, and it's almost like I was there. And that's what these types of experiences can do to you.
Right. Oh, I'm sure. You have said that if we continue releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and if climate change continues unabated, we cannot possibly cope with the consequences, whether it has to do with wildfires or whether it has to do with increasing flooding or any of the many other consequences of climate change that we're seeing emerging now. We cannot possibly cope. What do we have to do, Nikki?
Yeah. Well, there's basically two things. One is, as individuals, as communities, as businesses, as governments, everybody needs to do what they can to move away from fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal. And to help us do that, we need to use energy much more efficiently. We need to conserve where we can, turn lights off or turn the thermostat down, those types of things, maybe drive less. So we do those types of things at the personal level and then all the way up to the international level, working with other countries to drive emissions down. At the same time, we need to prepare for the types of impacts that are emerging and that we know are going to become more serious over time. In the short term, over the next several decades, we're pretty much locked into those impacts. But what happens beyond that very much depends on what we do in terms of emissions.
We're spending so much money now. You remind us that the amount of money to control fires used to be 17% of the Forest Service budget. It's now half.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really the issue that can keep me up at night, which is a pretty hard thing to do. If we do not curb our emissions, and if this, if climate change continues unabated, the consequences, the impacts, will become so costly that I'm concerned that they'll completely consume us. We'll be entirely consumed with just trying to deal with the impacts, and we really won't have the resources and the stability that we need for a quick and efficient shift over to a low-carbon future. So we really need to do all of these things quickly. We need to be focused. We can't delay anymore. I mean, you pointed out that I've been working on this issue for decades. We've, in a sense, lost several decades. We can't lose another decade. We really need to act now.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Nikki Sunt is our guest this hour. Nikki used to be a smoke jumper for six seasons, worked as a firefighter for the Forest Service from 76 to 1990. He's been working on climate change for three decades. He edited Global Change magazine and Energy Economics and Climate Change. He now works for the World Wildlife Fund. And he's talking about the frequency of forest fires in the United States, how many millions of acres have burned, how it's incredibly expensive to fight these, that we don't have enough firefighters, and they're putting their lives at risk to fight the intensity of these blazes, and they just keep getting bigger and more frequent as the years go on. He believes, due to, many others do, climate change. Here's our phone number. We welcome your calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we have many phone calls coming in. Let's start with Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As a conservative who happens to believe in climate change, I'm often concerned with the fact that a lot of the predictions that were involved with climate change from 10 years ago, 15 years ago, haven't really been met. Are there any specific predictions that have been met that support climate change, and how should we answer people when they say this was predicted and that it hasn't occurred yet? Thanks very much.
Nikki?
Yeah. So if I understand your question, you're asking about the future projections and how credible they are.
Yeah, he's saying I didn't quite get the question. He's saying that many of the predictions 10 years ago didn't come true. Is that what he was saying? Yeah, I think that's what he was saying. Have they?
Yeah. Oh, I think that what's happened is that we've seen these emerging consequences happening sooner than what we thought, not just in terms of fires, but in terms of a whole range of impacts, particularly in places like the Arctic, where we've seen the dramatic decline in Arctic sea ice, which has had profound implications not just for the Arctic but for the entire globe. I think that the science projects a range of possibilities. Some of them are more have a global increase in temperatures that's more rapid. Some of them have temperature increases that are slower. Some of them assume that we get a better grip on emissions and drive them down. Others assume that emissions will continue unabated. I think that right now we're well within projected range of both emissions and temperature. And in terms of the impacts to the forest, I mean, we've seen, since I was fighting fire, the average annual number of large wildfires has doubled.
Mm.
And there's been a dramatic increase in the average acreage burned. In the 1980s, the large fires typically burned in total in a year a 500,000 acres. And since the turn of the century, the average has been about four times that. So these are entirely consistent with with what we expected to happen. And I should add that there are the latest research suggests that in the lower 48, a 50% increase in lightning strikes over the next century. So, and that will ignite a lot more fires. So all of these things, I think, are pointing in the same direction.
Susan in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering about wildlife. I mean, when these fires are raging out of control, where do the animals go? I mean, they must be terrified. I mean, the news focuses on homes and on people. But what about all the animals and the insects and the birds?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's also just domestic animals, right? Horses and cattle and so on that are fenced in that can't really get outside of those enclosures if a fire comes through. In fact, I remember in the late 70s, I was working on a helicopter crew in Wyoming, and one of the things that we had to do was basically cut barbed wire fences so that the animals could get away from the fire on their own. Mm. Wildlife, some wildlife, it depends on the fire, you know, how fast it's moving. If it's not moving too fast, then the wildlife just gets out of the way of the fires. And so when my experience was when we were fighting fire, we'd see animals just outside the perimeter of the fire that had been driven out of there. Sometimes the animals don't get out. They're consumed. They're burned. And we find sometimes animals that the carcasses of animals that have been burned. And in some cases, we find animals that are they're not killed, but they're injured. Their paws might be burned. And actually, that goes back to the story of Smokey the Bear, who originally was a cub who was, I think, found clinging to a tree with his paws burned. So, yeah, it really is a concern. And of course, once the fire burns through, you've completely transformed that whole ecosystem. And so they may not be able to go back there for a while. On the other hand, there are, you know, other wildlife that will move in very quickly, too.
Thank you, Susan, for the call. Chris in Wisconsin Dells wants to know if there are regions that are currently on fire that haven't typically seen fires. She's concerned about the Olympic National Forest.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Again, usually, so in the Pacific Northwest, you've got the Cascade Mountains that kind of divide the state between the western third and the eastern two-thirds. The Cascade Mountains kind of wring the moisture out of the air that's coming off the Pacific, so you get a lot of rain on that west side, and it tends to be pretty dry on the east side. So it's not often that you see fires burning in places like the Olympic National of the Olympic Peninsula, because I mean, literally, that there's a rainforest there. It's wet all the time. And this year, they had just a really unprecedented fire on the Olympic Peninsula, and that was extremely unusual. Beyond that, beyond these fires that are in some cases burning on the east side of Oregon and Washington, I'm not really aware of other examples, but there may well be some, say, in the coastal northern California.
Bob in Iowa. Hi.
Hey, Nick, good job on this.
Thank you.
I fought fire back in the late 70s in California and Arizona. And 1 year I was on the biggest fire in the continental United States, which was 200,000 acres. That wouldn't even make the news nowadays. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a big fire. It went on for 3 months. 5,000 guys fought it. Anyway, so good job on this. Anybody that doesn't believe that the fires are getting bigger and hotter, you should get them hired by the Forest Service. They're looking for people, and you'd believe it pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, on a personal note, we used to carry fire tents all the time. We used to call them shake and bakes. We never had to use it, luckily enough. Have you ever met anybody that actually deployed their fire shelter and survived? And what kind of story did they tell?
Well, Nick, he has that story. Nick has that story.
Yeah, but he didn't get burned over,
but,
from my understanding.
Yeah, we didn't get burned over, and we were very lucky. That's a really good question. I personally know of anybody. I know that there have been crews that have deployed shelters and that have where the fire has come through, but I really don't know how much heat they were exposed to. My sense is that in a really the kind of fire that we were dealing with, which was a big crown fire that was moving through the tops of the trees, called a crown fire. The heat's so intense in those situations that I don't think that those fire shelters really are going to save you. But I do think that if you've got a clearing where you've cleared the vegetation and it's not piled up all around you, a fire that moves through in those situations where you're just getting a certain amount of radiant heat, I think that it's probably a pretty effective safety mechanism, which is why they require all the firefighters to carry them.
Well, how long do these fires last? When you talk about the fires going through, is that a pretty slow process, or does it vary from fire to fire, Nikki?
Yeah, it varies a lot depending on the fuel types. So you've got everything from, say, knee-high grass, cheatgrass, which burns very quickly, and you probably can't outrun.
Mm-hmm.
When it's really dry, it's wind-driven. Or you've got other fires that are in maybe heavier fuels that may not be as dry, that may be on flat land as opposed to on a slope. So there's all sorts of factors that are involved. I would say probably the biggest ones are the type of fuel, the topography, whether it's moving uphill or downhill, and then the wind and the temperature. So all of those things kind of combined. But there's certainly fires that you simply cannot outrun. And if you don't have an area already picked out and a route to get there that will be safe, you can be trapped.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we have made, as a society, I think most people have made a connection between these fires and other things that are happening on this planet and climate change? What about the response to it? What has our response been? Is it vigorous? Is it tepid? Is it almost non-existent?
I wouldn't say, well, over the period of time that I've been working on this, which is almost my entire adult life, I have to say that I would have hoped and I expected us to be much further along than we are. It really concerns me that we still haven't, at this point, driven emissions down lower than what they are. So I would say our response so far has been inadequate. But on the other hand, I think we now have a president who really does get it, who's doing what he can. In fact, in less than a week, the president and the Secretary of State and the President's Science Advisor are going to be in Anchorage, Alaska, to talk about climate change impacts in the Arctic with foreign ministers from other countries, primarily countries around the Arctic. Part of the focus of this meeting is going to be on climate change and the impacts that are being felt in this region and the implications, the global implications of those, with the idea that going forward in December, all the countries are going to be meeting in Paris for international climate negotiations. So this is one of the key steps on the way to Paris to reach an international agreement to reduce emissions and to keep this kind of situation from getting far, far worse as we go into the middle of the century.
Mm-hmm. And we're slow to action. Why?
Oh, boy. I could go on and on about that. I think one of the reasons is that some of the things that we need to do, particularly in terms of reducing our energy, our use of fossil fuels, it's not easy. And there are entrenched interests that are really have invested a lot in these fuels and have systematically, in some cases, undermined efforts to act on climate change. I think that's part of it. But then there's just, I think that people, sometimes it's hard to get people to change. And a lot of this, you know, people don't necessarily understand fully the science. So I try to be understanding of that and do what I can to explain things. But I think ultimately what's likely to really motivate people are these kinds of fire seasons where people see conditions that are so far beyond
yes.
their experience and that shake them so deeply
mm-hmm.
that it opens them up to really taking more seriously the challenge of acting on climate change.
Bob, thanks for your call. Mike is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you today?
Okay. How are you?
I'm super. Thank you. I'm okay. Sitting up in an off-the-grid cabin up in Fort Wayne, Wisconsin, and I'm a big fan of green technology. So this has been an interesting year. We've had a lot of smoke from the fires out west that are hazing over Lake Superior off and on this mm-hmm. year. And I'm a little bit curious that it took the Dust Bowl to the mid-30s to get government to wake up. And I'm really wondering if maybe these fires aren't the equivalent to that, that the government needs to see what's going on and start to pass or support green technologies a little more than they are. They're real quick to support big oil and things like that, and it just seems like with green technology, it always takes a back seat.
I think that the fires can help move people, certainly in the Pacific Northwest. I think that in other parts of the country that really aren't experiencing this firsthand, it may take a different kind of impact, maybe with more local consequences to really move them, and it may have to happen many times. I mean, one of the things that's really surprised me is of the parts of the country that have been hit the hardest by some climate extremes, which they tend to be around the Gulf of Mexico, and it mostly has to do with hurricanes. Those are some of the areas of the country that have been the least progressive in terms of climate policies. And so I think in some cases it really takes a lot. It can take many years, multiple shocks, before people are really willing to let go of the way that they've done things in the past and to really seriously consider doing things differently and shifting resources to a low-carbon future and to preparing for these impacts.
And do you find that people who have been shocked because of the proximity of the problem, the proximity of the fire or the flood, are more likely to act quickly?
Well, I think it kind of depends on the person. There are people who are, I mean, if you divided the American public up into, say, different groups ranging from the people who are alarmed about climate change to the people who are entirely dismissive, I think that these climate extremes tend not to move the people who already think, who are already dismissive. And there are some interesting explanations for that. So I think that where it's most important are for those people that are kind of in the middle. They're not rejecting it, but they're not quite bought into the idea. And I think for them, when they experience these types of impacts themselves or their family or friends do, I think then they tend to start shifting over a little bit towards being more supportive of action on climate change.
David sends this email. To a great degree, we've been creating our own problem by interfering with small forest fires, which have left an enormous amount of fuel on the forest floor. What do you think, Nikki?
Oh, totally. Yeah. That's actually how I got into this. Originally, before I really made the climate connection to wildfires, when I was working at the Office of Technology Assessment here in Washington, D.C., I did a study. I worked on a study of forest products, and I specifically looked at the issue of, you know, the amount of wood that was in the western United States. And it was very clear that we had a problem even without climate change in the West because of successful fire suppression, very aggressive and successful fire suppression over such a long period of time. So you get these big expanses of what we call fuel, which, you know, trees and vegetation and so on, so that when you do get a fire, even without climate change, it's going to tend to be bigger and it's going to tend to require more resources. But now essentially what we've done is we've thrown gasoline on the fire with climate change. And so it just makes it much more difficult to find a way out of that predicament, because if you let the fires, if you let the fires burn, which, you know, there are policies that try to do that within certain conditions. If you let them burn with the kind of conditions that we're seeing now in the West, they're more likely to escape your control. So even if you have what's called a prescribed fire that's designed to reduce the amount of fuel on the land, it can get away and it can really do a lot of damage. And so it's a real tricky kind of predicament.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the huge wildfires that are affecting Alaska and Canada, California, Oregon, Washington. 29,000 firefighters are battling 100 large blazes right now across the West, and that's not enough firefighters, so we're getting more firefighters who are volunteering and people from other countries. Our guest this hour made the connection between wildfires and climate change back in 1988 when he was fighting fires. Nicky Sunt, from 76 to 90, worked for the U.S. Forest Service as a firefighter. He was a smoke jumper for six seasons. He now works for the World Wildlife Fund, and we're talking about the changes in the frequency of forest fires in this country and the connection to climate change, and asking importantly, what do we do about it? 800-486-8655 is our number. One line is open. You can email us, talk@wpr.org. We always like to read your messages on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls for Nikki. Marianne in Door County. Hi.
Hi.
Turn your radio down, please, Marianne.
Pardon me?
Turn your radio down, please.
Oh, got it.
Great.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm hearing you out of two ears.
Go ahead.
Okay. I am constantly hoping and thinking that there might be a way of using the gangs that are so prevalent in our big cities, train them to be fire people, and let them go off and do something that would make them proud and also help in fighting the forest fires. These guys are just, you know, killing one another because they have nothing else to do and nothing else to be proud of. Use them.
Nikki.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that when I was fighting fire, when we were starting to have our resources stretched thin, that it was not uncommon for us to see sometimes either working on the fire line or in the fire camps or in some other kind of role, convicts from you know, kind of the lower risk folks who wanted to do something, who are willing to do this, and there were also a lot of crews that were drawn from these youth programs, like I forget what it was called, the Youth Conservation Corps or something along those lines. But they were basically young people, typically from the cities, who would be recruited, could earn some money, and could be outside and do something that really was meaningful. So I think that there really is an opportunity for you know, to engage, to solve multiple problems at the same time, and not only in terms of fire suppression, but also on the other end, where, you know, you're having to rebuild these communities, you know, to engage as many people as we can, particularly those who really are looking for, you know, some way out of an otherwise difficult situation.
How short are we of firefighters?
I can just offer you some anecdotal evidence. I know the fact that we're pulling firefighters, flying them all the way from New Zealand to Australia, suggests that we're in a really difficult situation. But I can tell you that about a week ago, I read an article about a fire chief, I think it was in California, whose community was at risk from a fire. And he called for support because he was going to lose his house. And he went from one place to another trying to get people to help out, and nobody was able to respond, and I believe that he lost his house. It's tricky because you can have a fire that needs, say, 5 20-person crews, and it only has a 20-person crew on it. And so, what would the fire have done if it had those 5 crews is anyone's guess, but I think it's pretty clear that the fire would have been smaller had they had enough people. Now, I think in terms of the resources, one of the most critical resources are what are called initial attack, which is the smoke jumpers are firefighters that are deployed through helicopters or other ways. And the idea is to get quickly to the fire and contain it before it gets big. And if you run out of those guys and gals, then you've got a real problem, because
right.
those little fires are going to turn into much bigger fires, and then, of course, they're going to require a lot more resources.
Calvin near Chicago. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Just a quick thank you for this subject so much. I listen to you as often as I can, and this one with Nikki is just terrific. My real question and point is, 90%, 95% of scientists agree we have global warming. We have a warmer climate. We talk about it all the time. Yes, President Obama is trying to get different changes and measures through. Yes, we have the new BAC standards, which requires lower emissions. But in general, we really have a problem because we don't have an energy policy, much less a renewable energy policy. And until we start using renewables on some kind of basis where we're totally committed, we are not going to make the changes, in my view, that we need to make so that we actually can begin to change global warming. So my question to you, Nikki, is what do we do to make the necessary legislative changes in our states and in Washington so that we can increase the use of lower emission energy? And I'll turn off now.
Thanks, Calvin.
Well, you're bringing up a really important point. I think that we talked about the need for everybody to reduce their emissions at every level and to prepare for climate change in different ways. But I think that one of the key things that we all need to do is, in terms of being good citizens, is knowing where your elected representatives stand on this issue. Find out where they stand. Make sure they know where you stand and act accordingly. Hold them accountable. When you have an election, find out what the candidates are saying about this issue. Find out what they're really going to do and make an informed decision about it. I think that that's really what it takes. If candidates and incumbents are hearing from their constituents that they consider this an important problem and that it requires action in terms of both reducing emissions and preparing for these consequences, then I think we're more likely to see movement. But right now, I don't think that we're really seeing that, at least not enough. And so the president's trying to move forward, but there's the Congress is not there, and so it makes it very difficult, at least at the national level. And same thing kind of goes for at the state and local level. You have quite a variety of differences among the states in terms of where they stand on climate change, with some like California who are feeling the impacts and have traditionally been fairly progressive in these things are further along, whereas other areas have a long ways to go.
Thank you, Calvin. Jerry in Stockbridge, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I understand now that our guest was talking about how containment, leaves more wood on the forest floor, more vegetation. This increases smoke when fires do break out, increases the chance of fire, and then increases the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere. Now, this is kind of a certain great dichotomy involved here, because planting trees, new forest growth, expanded forest growth, is one of the best cheapest ways to contain, to sequester carbon. That's how that carbon wound up in the fossil fuels to begin with, to start with. And just replanting and expanding and reforesting, you know, the country will help preserve water, moisture, cool the climate, and also sequester atmospheric carbon.
Nikki.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And here's what I would add to that is that right now, with the relatively slower pace of climate change, which is going to accelerate, but right now with the relatively slower pace, we have a better idea of what to plant in different places, and we can have a more reasonable expectation that those trees will actually survive. But if we fail to act and climate change accelerates even more, then we're going to get into a situation where the trees we plant today are going to not survive in the climate of tomorrow, and they're simply going to fuel the next series of fires. So we really need to act quickly. I totally agree. Planting trees, managing what we have better so that we don't get into these massive conflagrations. I think that that's important. And also planting trees in the urban context helps cool cities down and provides shade. So as well as locking up carbon. So it's a really, particularly in terms of the urban context, we need to do that, but we also need just to keep an eye on making sure that we do it in a way that doesn't create it doesn't aggravate the fire situation.
Mark has this question. I'd like to know about the recurrence of a fire in the same area. If a fire happened this year, how likely it would be for a fire next year in the same spot?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because this fire right now that's burning in Washington, which is where I used to be a smoke jumper, one of the places I used to be a smoke jumper on the Okanagan National Forest, it seemed like there were fires there every year. And there was a huge fire there last year, and now there's another one here there this year. So clearly, when you have a lot of fuel in a place and you have a fire, you're not going to recover that fuel very quickly. It can take a long time for that to regenerate. But let's say if you've in the Southwest, you have heavy brush and you have a fire that goes through there. But then let's say the next spring is wet. Well, then you get a different kind of fuel. You'll get these light grasses that, when they dry out, they can be very combustible and the fire can move very quickly through them. So you can have the same area burning multiple times over a relatively short period of time, but what you're burning and how much is and what the consequences are, how hot it's burning, that is going to vary just depending on what the first fire did and what the second fire did and so on.
Yeah. Time for one more call. Ron in La Crosse. Hi.
Yes. Despite, you know, all the record highs we've been having and the global warming deniers will say, well, the government's only been keeping track of temperature statistics since 1870 when Congress assigned to the U.S. Army. But there's a compelling logical argument for that fossil fuels are causing global warming. And these fossil fuels, coal, shale, and oil, really are millions of years' accumulation of decomposed vegetable matter from prehistoric times. And that vegetable matter stored solar energy. So when we start consuming any of those three, we are releasing a vast repository of solar energy in a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the time it took to accumulate it. And this is obviously going to have, I think, a severe effect on an atmosphere. It's only being about 3.5 miles thick.
Nikki.
Yeah. Right now, the carbon content of the atmosphere is higher than it's been for at least 800,000 years. And probably much longer than that. The only reason I mentioned 800,000 is that's as far back as our reliable data goes. No question that when we burn fossil fuels that we're releasing huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. It's showing the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere now is beyond anything that we've seen for just a very long period of time. And also, you know, some of these fires, say in Alaska, they because it's so cold there, you've got a lot of carbon in the soil.
We have to make it real short. We're almost out of time.
Okay. So there was a fire in 2007 in Alaska that that released the amount of CO2 that was equivalent to what the entire region pulled out of the atmosphere over a quarter of a century.
Ooh. Nikki, thank you so much for being with us. You're a superb guest. Nikki Sunt, now working for the World Wildlife Fund. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting show and Scotty Myers for on-air production.